later. All right. We had last time left off discussing Rashi's Perush. I want to summarize just a little bit what we said last, what I tried to get across last week. Number one, Rashi basically works through the collective Perushim of Mainz that had developed over the time, start in a process that was started by Rabbeinu Gershom Moragola. If you take a look at the Perushim of Rabbeinu Gershom Moragola, they not only overlap, but they're also multiple levels. You have different opinions and so on and so forth. What Rashi did was to try to develop a systematic, consistent interpretation to all of Shas, which allowed for a person who has a basic introduction to learning to be able to function on his own at different levels, whether it's a beginner, whether it's a more advanced student, and so on. He had a what he basically did was to what he achieved was to make the Gemara available to everybody. Took prior to that, if you wanted to learn, you had to go to yeshiva. You had to sit there. Whatever masechtas they learned when you were in yeshiva, you knew. What you didn't know, you didn't know. Now you can actually order a scribe to copy an entire commentary on all of Shas, or almost all of Shas. If there are some masechtas, it's not clear whether Rashi commented or not. Oh, it's probably he probably commented in all of Shas. And sit and learn on your own, which is an amazing act of democratization. In terms of that, so it's interesting. You have a very strong contrast to the kind of control of information that we saw among the Gaonim, which then goes through one change in the change of atmosphere in the yeshivot in Mainz and Worms in the Middle Ages, where the give and take is much more open, but you're basically institutionally restricted. And now you have a situation where you're not even institutionally restricted anymore, which doesn't mean that people don't go study with older and more experienced and greater scholars. But at least as far as basic information is concerned, you've got a tremendous. It's a, what do you want to call it? An information revolution. It's not quite the internet, but it's not dissimilar in that regard. One thing Rashi does do is he interprets Gemara's. He's generally sugya specific. In other words, he hones in and interprets the passages in the Talmud that he is discussing. He does not generally, there are exceptions, but generally not take into consideration things that are written elsewhere, even though he might be aware of them. As a result, it's somewhat, you have to be cautious in terms of quote Rashi to say that this is Rashi's approach to a specific halakhic problem. Generally, Rashi does not Paskin halachas. Rashi does not come out and say the din is this way, the din is that way. Prominent exceptions are in Chulin, for obvious reasons, and in Avodah Zarah. Rashi actually does have more to say halacha lemaisa in those two tractates, simply because of I assume because of the fact that they were so practical and they were so important. To give you an example, I want to give you an example, however, of one of the things which would prompt Rashi to make a halachic statement. Rashi generally hides behind his words. The first person singular does not appear generally in his commentary except to say, I don't know, and then the Yodea. You really need something very a powerful reason for Rashi to come out from behind the anonymity of his Perush and to say something, I say X. This is an example. Number one is a Rashi in Chulin, Daf Nun Bet Amud Aleph. The Gemara there talks about various. The Gemara there is from Perek Elu Trefot. Elu Trefot discusses the 70, all kinds of numbers, how many there are actually, of physical imperfections which render an animal not kosher. Now, you can shecht an animal properly, however, if it has certain physical imperfections, certain is damaged. Gemara, so the Mishnah assumes that there are actually fatal problems in the animal. Then the animal, despite the fact that being shechted properly, is osur. In the context of that perek, which is not generally learned in yeshivas today, and in fact it used to be required for smicha, and generally no longer is because of the industrialization of shechita and meat production. But it's certainly part of Torah. We should learn it. The Although I remember when I learned treifas for smicha, so I remember that it was my mother's Zechana Levracha was very upset because it's all about, you know, animals dying and diseased and so on, and it's a very depressing. Can't you learn something happier? I mean, well, I'm going to learn about cotton. Anyways, many of the treifas, according to Chazal, according to the Gemara, if you have an indication that there may be some sort of damage, some sort of pekam in the animal, which might render a treif, there are certain modes of examination which would allow you to determine one way or the other. The Gemara has a whole series of these. In that context, Rashi makes the following comment. Katuv ba'alachot gdolot. He says, in the Halachot Gdolot, which is a 9th century collection of Gaonic provenance, it's a book of Halacha, it has tremendous cachet, it's tremendous authority, because it comes from the Gaonim, because the author, Reb Shimon Kayara, was a Talmud Chacham of world stature, of really international stature. Katuv Halachot Gdolot, kol hecha debay bedika. In any situation in which you have a circumstance in which you suspect that the animal might be treif, as in the case of Nefula, if the animal fell down from a high place, or Shvura has a broken leg at certain places in the leg, or Drusa, or it was attacked by a wild animal, Dimit Kashri Bividika, that if you do the proper examination, you can determine whether it's kosher or not. Hani Milibatorit Kamai. That is only in the early generations, many years ago, Davo Bekila Mivdak, when they had the expertise to be able to examine the animals. Avad Anan, we, however, Lo Bekiinan, we lack that expertise, Velo Samchinan Nafshin, we don't rely on ourselves, and we don't rely on ourselves. Okay, that's in popular parlance, that's the Ich bin Gorsht, I'm a nobody kind of position. We can't do that anymore. We don't know, and so we always have to. What does that mean? It means that whenever you have a situation here, when a question arises, you automatically say treif. That's basically the implications. Now, in treifas, that's a major issue. I have to tell you, because they didn't have industrialized. There were no industrialized slaughterhouses. You had one Nebuch Sheikhid who bought a cow, used all his money, bought the cow, shechted the animal, and if the animal wasn't kosher, if the animal turned out to be treif, he lost his money. Or he had to try to sell it to a Christian or to a non-Jew, and generally the Christians didn't like the idea in the Middle Ages that the Jews are selling us meat, that diseased meat that they don't want to eat. And that became a serious source of anti-Jewish sentiment. But says the Halachos Gedolos, it does, you know, nevertheless, we can't rely on ourselves. Says Rashi, V'li nireh, nevertheless, I say, despite the authority of the Halachos Gedolos, let's be very clear. Okay, this is a very courageous thing to say. He quotes here Gemara in Baba Basra. You can't do that. Just because early generations might have been Gemara Rav Shana like this. We're greater than you. You have what you have. And we have a tradition how to check these things. And just because you might have the same level of expertise, you have what you have. And that does not preclude the continued use or reliance upon bidikot. Umutal l'smachalav. And you're allowed to do so. Dichtiv, as it says in the Torah in Parshat Beit Din HaGadol, you should go come to Shofet Ashriya b'yimim ha'heim. You go to the judge in your generation. The Gemara says in Rosh Hashanah Daf Yud Zayin Beis that you can't. You're not supposed to say, you're not Reb Moshe Feinstein. You're not the Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. You're not this one. You're not that. You can't paskin. What? So we can't go to dead people. You're not allowed decromancy's author. You're not allowed to bring back the dead. So what are you supposed to do? The Torah's not supposed to function. No, you go. You do the best you can with the tools that you have. In fact. And in that regard, the famous statement. The Gemara there in Rosh Hashanah says, "Yiftach bedoro kishmul bedoro." You know, if all you have in a yiv is in your generation is a yiftach who was not the guy you'd want to have your sister bring home to meet your parents. Then that's what you got. That's the shofet asher yiyeh b'yimim ahem. And if you have Shmuel, also better. By the way, as a friend of mine who's a Rosh Hashiva once pointed out, that Shmuel lived after Yiftach. So apparently the decline of the generations is not necessary. Later generations are not necessarily less than the earlier generations because Shmuel lived after Yitzchak. So apparently, after Yiftach. So apparently things actually can get better when there is room for optimism. In any event, he says you have what you have. Aval hu yizaher yafeh. Whoever the judge is should be cautious and be responsible in executing these in executing these forms of examination. You bring all the experts, all of the shochtim and all the butchers, and all of the people who have expertise, and you consult them, and then you make a decision based on knowledge. And you don't paralyze the system. What is Rashi polemicizing against? Just one book? No. Apparently, there were people at the time who were maintaining this position. And in fact, on the next daf, this is Nun Beis Amud Aleph, on Nun Gimel Amud Aleph already, or it's a daf before, I forgot to check, Tosfos says that when it comes to lesions along, we don't check anything, we just say it's all treif. So apparently, and that's the line, by the way, that ended up becoming adopted by Ashkenazim. Sfardim and Yadot HaMizrach still do these examinations and allow the animals, if they pass the test. And the Ashkenazic position is, in fact, that no, we just say that everything's treif. But Rashi here, so my point is that Rashi here comes from behind the cloak of out of humility. Rashi was a phenomenally humble individual, and of anonymity, and says, you know, feels he has to make a statement in the contemporary context, so he does so. And again, so that's one of the examples where Rashi actually comes out and tries to paskin and paskin halach instead of just being sugya specific. Okay, now once Rashi, yes.
In the situation where Rashi does come out and say he doesn't know, is he saying he doesn't know for a reason?
No, because he doesn't know.
Trying to tell something else?
I personally understand that as being Rashi, the ultimate pedagogue. Let me go back again to what I said a few minutes ago. And here I'd like to adopt basically the description that was actually mentioned in a number of occasions. My teacher, Professor Chaim Soloveitchik. The Gemara per se is a very styptic text. He likes to point out that if you took down the Sansino translation, as you know, before there was Rabbi Schottenstein and before Rabbi Steinsaltz did his thing, before there was Rabbi Artscroll rather, we take the Schottenstein, the Sansino, which translates the words of the Gemara. They can read the words, but you don't have a clue what they're talking about. Okay, you can follow what's going on, you know, more or less, but you what's missing is pagina, is punctuation. Is background in, is reference, our side references to fill out the very he calls it a telegraphic or telegramic kind of structure to be able to know what's going on. Rashi, what Rashi does is he takes you by the hand, provides all the supplementary what is referred to, brings in only the necessary background information, punctuates, and also eases you in the over the course of the back and forth in the Gemara, not to tell you what is there, but to sort of prevent you from going off on the wrong. On a wrong tangent, because if you assume something is a question or is not an or it's not a question, or if you assume something means A but it really means B, or if you understand that the questioner refers to something earlier not something later, you will misunderstand the you could possibly interpret the entire passage, but you'll misunderstand the entire point of the discussion. Most of what Rashi uses to do that comes from this tradition of Magensa, but he was not only a brilliant interpreter, he's not only a brilliant writer, but he was also a brilliant pedagogue. And his pedagogy is incredible. When he tells, as we said, when he tells you don't worry about this, it'll get dealt with later, and so on, just keep going. Similarly, I think that this is another example of Rashi's pedagogy by saying, I don't know. Rather than leaving you first of all, if you find something you don't understand, and Rashi didn't say he doesn't know what it is either, what'll happen? You might stop, you might feel stupid, whatever the case may be. Rashi says, I don't know, you'll go look, you'll try to find, you'll try to fill in where Rashi actually missed the, didn't understand something. Or you'll understand that this is something which is, this is a piece of data, this is a datum which I have no idea what it means at the moment, and try nevertheless to deal with the sugya despite that, and how does Rashi try to compensate, and so on and so forth. So I think that's more a matter of Rashi as a pedagogue than Rashi as, than anything else. It's very easy to be quiet, to be silent, and pretend as if you know, and just skip over things, and people say, well, he must know he's a genius, and they feel bad, as opposed to being a real teacher, saying, you know, I really don't know what this means, let's try to deal with this, you know, in the absence thereof, and so on, okay? I think that's what we're talking about. Okay, Once Rashi's Peirush was completed and it started spreading, now we know, originally we thought it took a while, but now we know that already there are indications that the teacher of Rambam's father, the Rabbi Yosef ibn Migash, who I hope to talk about it next week or the week after, had Rashi in front of him. The job was done. It doesn't mean that you don't disagree with certain interpretations. People have been disagreeing with Rashi ever since the generation after Rashi. But the point is, as a whole, the whole Gemara is done. The whole Gemara is accessible to you. There's one single vision of what the Gemara means in front of you with which you can interact. Okay? And once that was done, two things happened. First of all the other previous attempts to do so disappeared. Okay, the only reason we have certain parts of the old Mainz commentaries is because there were certain sechtes upon which we either don't have Rashi or Rashi didn't write. Okay, so they were substituted by the printers in the late Middle Ages, early modern Renaissance, whatever you want to call it, in the late 15th, early 16th century, or they're mentioned secondhand. Other than that, there was no reason to keep copying them because you had Rashi. The same thing, Rabbeinu Hananel, we saw, tried to do something similar, and he had influence in other ways, but in terms of the content of his positions, but as a commentary, there's no comparison to what Rashi did with his interlinear commentary, and Rabbeinu Hananel only exists as an add-on, okay? And the same is true of others. Many of these things, Rabbeinu Hananel in its totality, is only being published from manuscript now because there was no reason to keep publishing it. You had Rashi. No one ever, ever, ever subsequently felt the need to try to interpret the Gemara again. And if you take a look, the one possible exception is Rabbi Steinsaltz, who tried to translate everything into Hebrew to address a secular Israeli audience. The one time I had a conversation with him, which was almost 40 years, more than 40 years ago. No, it was like 40 years ago, actually. He said he wanted to make sure that Israeli Jews were not Amoratzim so that they would have the kind of Jewish literacy that he thought was necessary for a common cultural language in the state of Israel. And Rashi and Rabbi Steinsaltz in his Gemara puts Rashi there because Rashi is inherent. Rashi is integral to the whole business. And, by the way, if you look at all the knockoffs, if you look at Art School and you look at Chavruta and you look at all these other guys who put out knockoffs of Schottenstein, on the page, 9 times out of 10, all they do is put Rashi inside the lines. Because there's nothing else, it's been done. By the time Rashi died, it was done. All right. Now, so for the first time in, what, the Gemara was redacted, let's say, around 500, 550, 500 years later, or more, 550 years later, it's done. The Gemara is now accessible to everybody. Once that happens, we move on to stage next. Okay? And stage next is Tosfos. What's Tosfos? What is it? So they'll tell you that it's a question whether it's Tosfos on the Gemara. What are Tosfos? Tosfos are comments. They're addenda, if you want. They're little essays, little pointed essays on specific issues in the Talmudic text, which are made possible because you don't have to worry about what the basic text means because Rashi's already taken care of that again. There is a fundamental difference of opinion as to what the word Tosafot means. Does it refer to additions, addenda, comments, essays, whatever you want to call it, on glosses, is the fancy word you should know, in scholarly literature? Are they Tosafot on Rashi? Or are they Tosafot on the Gemara? Now, you'll find that Tosafot not only doesn't always take Rashi as the point of departure. Sometimes it sees a problem in a Gemara and it makes a comment. And sometimes, or very often, it's Perish HaKuntris. Sometimes, much of the time, their point of departure is Rashi. Because once Rashi interprets a Gemara one way, then, I think about it one way, so I can think about another way. But the point of departure, Keresh Machpitzai, the springboard, the diving board for the discussion into the pool of Talmud, or Yama Talmud, if you want to call it, is Rashi. Part of that discussion is based upon the question of where, who first, what did Tosfos do, and who did it first. So I'd like to comment first is what did Tosfos do, and then we'll try to answer the question of who did it first. Take a look. The person who I think actually put it nicely, best, did it best 400 years after the Baalei Tosfos, and that is Rabbi Shlomo Luria. Shlomo Luria was really one of the two Gedolei Hador in Poland in the 16th century, the other being his first cousin, Rav Moshe Isserles. Among the places he was the rabbi, by the way, was in Brisk, although he had no idea what was going to come later in Brisk. He just, you know, apparently it's like they say, Avir Eretz Yisrael Machkim, that the heir of the land of Israel makes you smart. So apparently, well, he was smart when he got there, but so was Reb Chaim for that matter. But apparently the heir in Brisk makes you smart. He lived from 1510 to 1573. He wrote, he's most famous, among other things, for his series of books called Yam Shel Shlomo, in which Yom Shel Shlomo didn't like the idea of writing Sifrei Halacha. He didn't like the Shulchan. He didn't like the Beis Yosef. He didn't like the Darchei Moshe, and then he didn't like the Shulchan Aruch. He didn't like the what his cousin did in the Hagos and the Mappa to the Shulchan Aruch. He was of the opinion, not unlike in the tradition, actually, the Maharal of Prague, that if you want to learn properly la halacha, you got to start with the Mishnah. You start with the Mishnah and the Gemara, and then you work through all the sugyas, and then you work all through all the Rishonim, and you delineate all of the Shitos, and then you work through all the later authorities. I'm not going to get into the question of who's a Rishon, who's an Achron, and finally you come to a Psak Halacha. So he says in the introduction to his book that he figured he'd sit down and he would knock off Shas and all the halachah lemaisa mesechtas and goodbye. He managed to do, I think, 7 of all of them. There are all these long, interesting essays, and they're very important. In any event, in his introduction, which is a very important text, which we will read part of now and part of in a little bit, he talks about the Shalshalat HaMasoret. He talks about the way that the Torah Shebal Peh unfold. Unfortunately, I could not get it was too clumsy to schlep up my copy up on top. This is you can probably tell this is from HebrewBooks.org because that's what they had scanned. He writes as follows: V'nachzor l'rishonot l'Talmud asher anu oskim bo. First, we're going to come to the Talmud which we occupy ourselves. U'mimenu anu shotim, from which we drink. Lulei chachmei atzorfatim. Balei atosafot sha'asau asauhu oto kador echad valeim ne'amar divrei chachamim kadabanot hafchu v'gigalu mimakom l'makom ad shenirela keechad mibli soter mibli oker. What's he talking about? The Balei Tosfos, like everybody who learned Gemara, was very much aware of the fact that the Gemara is full of apparent contradictions. Okay, this thing which was redacted and edited by Ravina Ravashi, by the Svarayim, whoever it was, and integrated, it was not, even though it seems to have gone through that process, still has all kinds of problematic disconnects and contradictions and so on and so forth. So the question is, how do you deal with these contradictions? Okay, the Gemara wasn't put together in a happenstance manner. So what does it mean? Are you supposed to decide between them? How are they supposed to function? What is supposed to happen over here? There were in that context. Okay, sometimes. All right. So when you have a contradiction, there were two major ways of dealing with a contradiction. One major way of dealing with contradictions is to say one side is right and one side is wrong. Right? Good. I paskin. This, he says A, he says B. I paskin like A, I paskin like B. Goodbye. That's one way of doing it. Another way of doing it is something called dialectic. Dialectical argument says that really is contradictions within the work of a specific author or group of authors, is our text, the Gemara, are not really contradictions. They actually refer to two different situations, which can be a fact which can be proven by deeper analysis of the location in which each opinion is noted. And you see that this really refers to A, this really refers to B. There's no real contradiction, but you really have to understand the context of each statement to be able to understand that. That is called argument by distinction. This is A, this is B. Among those in the Babylonian and later the Spanish tradition, there is a certain amount of dialectical argumentation. You see it in the Rambam, you see it in Reb Magash and others, But in general, if you have a machloket halacha lamaisa, all right, or machloket lahalacha between two opinions, and in general the Sfardim emphasize those sugyas that are more halacha lamaisa, there was this concept called the sugya d'shmaitza, or the sugya d'shmatita. In other words, if you have the same issue comes up three different times. But one of the contexts is obviously the central discussion, because the context is refers to that issue. We follow that, and the other two are considered to be sort of leave them by the way. Okay, that's one way of doing it. Another way of doing it, which is the way the Balei HaTosfos saw it, they viewed the Gemara as they believed Rav Ashi presented and Ravina presented to them as an integrated whole. That's why the Marshal refers to the Gemara as a, it's a Balei HaTosfos say, making it into a ball. What is a ball? Good, it's a round thing. It's also a circle. So is the hole to the miklat over there. What is a ball? A ball is a sphere. A sphere is the most perfect geometrical form, because in a sphere, everything relates to every single thing. Every single point in a sphere can relate easily to every single other point in the sphere. And you roll it this way, you roll it that way, and everything actually relates to everything else. So Balei HaTosfos made it into a sphere, saying that, no, so it's an integrated whole, so therefore if there's a contradiction, I have to bring everything into consideration and try to determine how is it that it all integrates without contradiction, because contradictions are not possible in an integrated whole. They're not possible in the most beautiful and the most perfect geometrical form. So therefore, the Balei HaTosfos said, you have to be able to constantly work with distinction. Distinction might be between that the two sides of a contradiction may refer to different issues. They may reflect two different opinions. They may, whatever the case might be. But you use the entirety, you bring to bear the entirety to be able to illuminate a specific point. That's why you have these long Tosfos in the learning Subas, there are dozens of them, in which Tosfos brings sites 85,000 Gemaras to illuminate one specific point. You have it this, and this. So you have it, for example, I don't know, did you learn the sugya about Psikresha lo nichalei, the machlokas, the aruch, and the whatever? You see, the aruch has five Gemaras over here, and this guy's got seven over there, and rated time says like this, and this like, you're working all of Shas simultaneously. Now, that is the hallmark of the Balei HaTosfos. And ultimately speaks to the question of Tosfos to what? There were those who argue that there were early German scholars who were contemporaries of Rashi, especially one Rabbi Yitzchak ben Asher, the Riva, who already starts noticing the fact that you have to bring the entire Gemara into other contradictions, and you have to try to resolve them, and so on and so forth. But he doesn't do it on a global scale, and one of the reasons he doesn't do that is because Rashi made it possible to do that. It used to be that you had to learn Shas from Brachas to Nida, and all the time sit there forever and have plowed through everything to be able to compare and contrast to master the entire work. But once Rashi has made the entire thing available, you can start flipping back in pages. So as Rashi's basic field work that made Tosfos possible. So therefore, historically speaking, Tosfos really are a function as a result of Rashi. Rashi liberated intellectual energies to be able to concentrate on deeper understanding of how Shas works. Now, I want to give you an example of how comparing and contrasting of how Tosfos functions. But before I do that, I want to just make one comment. Tosfos really, when we talk about Tosfos, we're really only talking about seven people. Okay, let me be careful here. What the person who really registered and who has the copyright on Tosfos is Rashi's grandson, Rabbeinu Yaakov ben Meir Tam. Rabbeinu Tam, who lived first in Ramiru and afterwards in Tua. Why? Because Rabbeinu Tam was the one who was able to, first of all, scan all of Shas and raise hundreds and thousands of contradictions and multiple answers and solutions to the issues. And he also realized what the implications were of this new method for Talmud Torah. Because when you, if see, let me put it this way, if you, the dialectic, by the system of Balei Tosfos by definition expands, makes Talmud Torah from a from a confined enterprise to an ever-expanding enterprise. So, for example, if you say that the contradiction between, if you say that there's a stira, that there's a machlokas, you paskin like A, so A is the answer. You have one answer. If, however, if you say that they're both right, but this refers to A and this refers to B, A and B, in other words, new concepts, the new concepts take a line of their own. All of a sudden, you find new ways to put them in where they refer to things. And then when you compare and contrast, that leads to broader discussions and so on and so forth. In other words, the universe of discourse of Talmud Torah becomes ever that broader. Is that point clear? Yes. And it was Rabbeinu Tam who saw the possibilities and pushed him to the end. Rabbeinu Tam, however, did not write down. He wrote practically nothing. And the person who took everything that he, all of his ingenious and insights and so on, and who then sort of applied them shas wide, was his nephew, Rashi's great grandson, Ri Hazaken, Reb Yitzchak ben Shmuel of Dompierre, otherwise known as Ri Balei Tosfos, because he was the one who really was no less of a genius than Rabbeinu Tam, of a different type. He organized things and he took his fiery uncle's insights and quietly organized the Beis Medrash, in which he expounded and expanded and applied the Torot of his uncle. But he himself didn't write either. What he did was he would lecture, and he would appoint one of his students to write down his comments. Okay, and they would write them down. He would check out what he wrote down, the dictation, and then he would say, "That's fine. That's the comment on this Gemara." And at the bottom, the student wrote down "Mem Resh Mipi Rabbi." Later on, and they would say, "My teacher says this. This one says that." Later on, as the Tosfos became edited, so all these personal things fell away. If you take those original Tosfosin that we have and compare them to the ones on the Daf, you see that practically that overwhelmingly every single question and answer in Shas, in Tosfos on Shas, is a function of Rabbeinu Tam and Ri. To an overwhelming degree. Of course, other people functioned, other people write. But overall, the universe was set by these two. The Ri had three students who were important for us to mention, who wrote down and preserved their teachings. One was the Ri's son, Rabbeinu Elchanan, who was murdered al Kiddush Hashem in 1184. His second Talmud was Reb Shimshon of Sens, the Rash Mishans, otherwise known, who is responsible for a lot. You have them. Tosfos HaRashba on Ksubis is Tosfos, not the Rashba from Barcelona, Reb Shlomo Ibn Aderet, but Reb Shimshon ben Avraham of Sens, who wrote down Tosfos in front of the Ri. He was took the dictation of his Rebbe, the Ri. You also have Rabbeinu Baruch Balei Tosfos, and a couple of others. You're talking about a small group of people who ultimately were the creative element of Balei Tosfos, and everybody out there, with hundreds of Balei Tosfos, they wrote footnotes. The revolution was Rabbeinu Tam and the Ri in their immediate circle, and everybody else wrote footnotes, which is very good. You know, you have, it's like, you know, today you have a question on a Gemara, so you pull out a Ketos, you pull out a Nesivas, you pull out a Reb Shimon Shkop or something, you pull up a Reb Chaim, you feel really good, use somebody else's ideas mechanically to answer another question. A lot of the later Tosfos are like that, the mechanical application of the original creations of these six, seven Geonim. So what we have basically, I'm going to see in a minute, are Tosfos. The revolution was wrought between Rabbeinu Tam, who died in 1171, and the Aliyah of the Rash Mishans to Israel in 1211. So you're talking about a period of less than 100, of much less than, maybe less than 100, less of around 100 years. Okay, how does this work? How does this work? I mean, you've learned Tosfos before, but this happens to be a very good example where I can compare all of the different things that I can concretize everything that I've said to you. The Gemara says in Avodah, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, which is actually, as we saw, a Masechta that Rashi sort of interpreted from scratch. Okay, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah says that there are days upon which you're not allowed to do business with a non-Jew. Because you may end up causing him, if the business deal goes well, you'll cause the non-Jew to go and to worship his God and to say thank you. And since Avodah Zarah is not allowed, is prohibited to a Ben Noach, you actually are violating Lifnei Iver. Just like you can't ask a Jew, to even if he's not Shomer Shabbos, to do Malacha for you on Shabbos, so similarly you're not allowed to give a non-Jew to inspire or to cause a non-Jew to violate one of his Sheva Mitzvahs. So the question is, what are those holidays? So the holidays that are listed in the Mishnah in the first paragraph of Avodah Zarah are basically Roman holidays of different Roman religious holidays of different types. I've actually wondered whether actually I think this way. I actually think Halacha L'maaseh this way. I actually think that since most Eastern religions are probably Avodah Zarah, Hinduism certainly, Buddhism certain types definitely, Jain, Shinto, and so on, that the business people from around the world should actually walk, or Orthodox Jewish business people should have a little calendar, like when they're Yom Tovim are, because you probably should not do business with them on, at least not on their holidays. 3 days before is another story, but certainly on their holidays. But in any case, 3 days before, you're not allowed to do these Yom Tovim. So one of the holidays is the day the king dies. Why the day the king dies? Because, historically speaking, those were Roman emperors used to be turned into gods. They used to worship them afterwards. In fact, So the question is, and the Mishnah then says, it depends. Machlokas Reb Meir and the Chachamim. It depends what they do on the day the king dies. If they burn his possessions so that nobody else can use them, or is a sign of the fact he's become a god, then you are allowed. Then you're not allowed. If they don't, then the holiday has no significance, lichora. And Reb Meir says, doesn't matter. It's always a religious holiday. Now look at the Gemara number 2. Yom HaLeit of the Yom HaMisa, the birthday of the king and the death of the day the king dies. Michlal de Rabbi Meir Savar, since Reb Meir says it's, by definition, just any day the king dies, irrespective of what they do, Reb Meir says, Lo Shna Misa Sheesh B'Sreifa, Lo Shna Misa Eim B'Sreifa, whether they actually burn the possessions of the king or not, Pal Chibar L'Avodas Kochavim, it's obviously a day of it's not really the day the king dies, it's really the day the king's buried, or the day of the funeral, they worship Avodah Zarah. Alma, we can derive from that burning a king's possession, per se, lav chukahi, is not a chok l'avodah zarah, and therefore would not be a violation of the rule that you're not allowed to imitate Gentile ways, l'b'chukoteyam lo telechu. If that's the case, since Rabbanan say that the implication is, that the criterion is whether they burn the possessions or not, then obviously, klal de Rabbanan raise sreifa chukahi, then therefore it's clearly what renders it, since Rabbanan say that if they don't burn the possessions, it's not a religious holiday, so obviously what makes it a religious holiday or not is whether they burn the possessions of the king or not. Vahatanya, but we have a brisa that says that when it comes to Jewish kings, sorfin al malachim, you're allowed to burn their possessions, v'lo midachei emoyim, by definition that's not called a pagan practice. So how do Rabbanan work? If you say, according to Reb Meir, that the day itself is Avodah Zarah and the Sreif is irrelevant, so the Maisa works well. V'chukahi, and if this is a pagan practice, anahechi sarfinan, how do we do so? V'aktiv u'b'chuseyem lo telechu. Ella says the Gemara, de kuli alma sreif alav chukahi. So we have to derive that per se burning the king's possessions is not per se a pagan action. Ella kashivusahi. But rather, it's a sign of the dignity you attach to the person whose stuff you are burning. And therefore, if they burn it, it's an indication that they held this emperor in high esteem, and therefore they will epiphany him. Therefore, they will make him into a god. By the way, there were emperors that they didn't turn into a god. Claudius with difficulty. Nero, I don't think it was ever deified. And therefore the argument is whether Reb Meir Sava Lo Shna Misa Sheish Misreifa Lo Shna Misa Sheish Misreifa Palki Balos Chavim. Reb Meir says the day per se is a religious holiday irrespective of what they do. And Rabbanan Savri Misa Sheish Misreifa Chashiva Lo Palki Ba Vesheim Misreifa Lo Chashiva Lo Palki Ba. Okay, clear? Yeah, fair. Except, so according to this, according to the Gemara of Avodah Zarah, then something you have whether something is considered a chok, which you're allowed to do or not, depends whether it's inherently pagan or not. All right? Now that's a serious business. So for example, then you have a Gemara Nevoda in Sanhedrin, which is problematic. Mitzvah Sinerogim. Of course, one of the Arba Mises Bezdin is Saif, is cutting a person's head off. And says the Gemara, how do you perform that mitzvah? The most compassionate mode of execution of the Roman Empire was you cut your head off with a sword. I never understood the Daesh guys with the little knives. I mean, that's not classical Islam. But they're saying is do it like the Roman Empire does. And by the way, that was the privilege. The privilege of all Roman citizens was if you wanted to be executed, you'd say, I'd like to have my head chopped off with a knife, with a sword, because they did it from the back. You didn't know what was coming, and by the time it was over, your head was on the floor. Okay? Kederach shel malchutosa. Rabbi Yehuda omer, nivul hu zeh. That's disgusting. Ela menichin et rasho al hastan. Rather, you put your... put the guy's head on an anvil, the kotates, so you take a mace and you blast his head to smithereens, you smash his head to smithereens. Rulo, the Chachamim looked at him and says, what are you, nuts? That's disgusting. You say this is disgusting. This is disgusting. It's gross. What are you talking about? Says the Gemara, Tanya Amar lehem Rabbi Yehuda l'Chachamim. So Rabbi Yehuda said to Chachamim, Atman yodea shemisa mizuel. So I know that. I know that this is a gross way to die. Aval ma'aseh, what can I do? Share amra Torah b'chusem lo telechu. The Torah says you're not supposed to do anything that the goyim do. Anything, even when it comes to ways of modes of execution. And the Mishnah says Chachamim say you do exactly, you imitate what the goyim say. I disagree with you on this point. B'chusem lo telechu. So kak, it's a good question. Since the sword is a mode of execution and of killing people is mentioned in the Torah, lo minayu kai gamrinan, we don't learn from them. In other words, according to Rabbanan, who ostensibly Paskin-like, the definition of a chok is not anything which is extra Jewish is osur. However, if they do something which we do also in here, indigenously, that doesn't render it osur. So that's whoa. You're talking about two extremes. According to the Gemara of Avodah Zarah, everything is mutter. You can imitate the outside world and everything except something which is inherently pagan. And over here, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, you can't do anything that they do unless you can prove it's an indigenous development. Or at least it's something which passes well within Jewish tradition. So that's a pretty extreme case. So how do you deal with that? So turn the page. So here we have an example of precisely the two methods of dealing with this kind of contradiction that I mentioned. We don't have time to read the riff. Take a look at the Ran. The Ran on the riff in Avodah Zarah says, Sorfin al malachim v'lo midache amori, eina midache amori. Nothing is considered to be Gentile pagan ways, lachush, such that would engender we should be concerned that you'd be violating b'tchukotem lo telechu l'dol ta'aseh k'maaseihem l'fisha lo asra Torah ela chukot l'avora kochavim elu dvorim shel hevelu v'atala. Only things which are inherently pagan, which are, I think what he means here is really religious. Things which are super rational. Okay, you only do it because of the fact that the pagans worship that way. The kulam yesh behem tzarech avodas kochavim, but they're all part of the. They have a pagan idolatrous need of al dvarim shel tam, but things which are rational, which anybody would come up with, sharu, those are allowed. Ubisreifa shal malachim tam eika, and when it comes to burning the possessions of a king, there's a really rational reason to do it. L'srof l'chvodan klei tashmisham, so nobody else should use them. Okay, that's how we paskin. So what does he do? The Ran is very simple. The Ran says, you know what? There are two sugyas. There are two discussions of the question of chukos hakum. There's the one in Avodah Zarah, and there's one in Sanhedrin. Let me ask you a question. What's the more logical locus for the discussion? Avodah Zarah or Sanhedrin? Avodah Zarah! Because that's what we're talking about. It's like Paschal. I can learn Avodah Zarah. The sugya de shmatza is an avodah zara. That's classic Sephardic psak. Okay? Tosfos, on the other hand, he doesn't do that. Tosfos says, no. Why? If that's the case, why is it there? If I don't need it, why did Ravina and Rashi bother? It's there for a reason. So they work with the concept of, in Latin it's called distinctio, making a distinction that they each relate to both. We're going to skip in the middle. I should have just brought this. You see, the Tosfos in the first part of the Tosfos on the daf says, Lechach perish ri, therefore Rabbi Yitzchak Midom Pierre says, the trei gavni chukahavu, there were two types of chok, and each sugya refers to a different one. Echad she'osim l'shem chok avodas kochavim, one which is inherently religious. In other words, if I wanted to adapt crossing myself to Jewish concern, to the Jewish religion, that would be awesome, okay? Ve'echad, and another one, that's what's referred to in avodah zarah. Ve'echad she'osim l'shem dat hevel u'shtut shalem, and another which is an expression of their empty, vacuous, stupid religion, ways, culture, something like that, which is a much more broad issue. But the result is that there are two different types, each one refers to a different type, and there are two criteria. And in fact, the truth of the matter is that Tosfos is very machmir on what you're really allowed to adopt from the outside world or what you're not allowed to adopt from the outside world. Now this, so you see, I'm just trying to give you the example of distinction. Happens to be, when it comes to this specific Tosfos, we happen to have the Tosfos of Rabbeinu Chanan, the son of the Ri, who wrote down what his father had to say under his tutelage before he died, obviously 1184, which means that the Ri learned the Avodah Zarah before 1184, before his son was murdered. Okay? Take a look at how the text has it here. V'nira l'Rabbeinu. He's calling his father Rabbeinu. Okay? Our master assumes. You're talking, but this is really, you're talking a lifetime. The trei gavnei chukahi, there are two types of chok. The sreifa chukahi, the hacha hainu sh'ovde kochavim choshvim mashasorfim amalochim l'shem avazar miskavnim. The chomer midarchei amori shalehem she'e. So first of all, you have some which are more severe because the non-Jews consider this to be a profoundly religious moment, and therefore it's more serious. You should be machmir more and distance yourself more from these than any other type of Gentile actions, as opposed to other things ela toras psul ba'alma. Otherwise, yeah, non-Jewish actions which are not acceptable, but they're less import. V'hilkach chukah d'sreifa afagav d'chibel raisa lo minayu kagamrinam yesh lan aposlo. Therefore, even though chok, if it was written in the Torah, should be prohibited. And what's the other kind? Look down the next page. Line number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. The chukah shayach b'shar dachei ha'amorim, ha'dvar dachei ha'amorim, or as ha'dvar dachei ha'asurim, or emurim, de'enam l'shem levodus chava, eladat ha'ovdei kochavim u'minag torat sheker shalahem. Something which is not quite religious, but part of a cultural nexus that should also be, he doesn't say give you examples at the moment, he gives you examples later, but anyways. All right, and then, but you see here that, first of all, you see that there is, that what the reset is not what's in Tosfos. The original report is a little less harsh, actually. Dat Torah Tsheker is not as bad as Hevel and Shtut, right? Number one. Number two, he discusses he changes the formulation. Now check down to the next paragraph. I'm not going to go into the teretz. Notice he says, Ubishem Rabbeinu Yaakov Peresh B'Sanhedrin. He says, not only that, but Rabbeinu Yaakov, who is what? My great uncle, Rabbeinu Tam, he says Y and Z. So here in this Tosfos, you have a sense of what was going on in the Beis Medrash of the Ri as he was dictating these comments to his son. Okay, and then in the 13th century, when it was rewritten by Rabbeinu Peretz of Korbei, you end up with something a little less intimate, a little bit less emphatic, and actually rewritten to a certain degree. Why is the later version a lot stronger anti-Gentile culture than what Rabbeinu Elchanan says? Perhaps because 60 years had gone by in which Jews have been persecuted and the attitude to the outside world was a lot sharper. I don't know. But the point of the matter is, the disc gives you this idea of how Tosfos came into being. And then they got edited as time went on. Okay, you know what? I will save the rest for the last point for next week. And next week, in Mitzvah Shem, we will discuss, we'll start discussing the early Rishonim of Spain. And then in the last session, Mitzvah Shem will talk about the Ramban, the Rajba, and the Ritva. And with that, I think we'll come to an end. Yes, hold on. Yes.
So, I don't know, sometimes it's like in a shiur or someone